New Zealand's first World War deaths in France alone make up 25% of the total New Zealand war dead in the 20th century.
...1,205 men from the New Zealand Division went missing during the battles of the Somme in 1916. This memorial in Longueval is dedicated to them. France knows what it owes to these young soldiers. They know, and they do not want to forget.
Many visitors to the Somme visit the beautiful Delville Wood, and they walk around and consider the sacrifice of the South Africans who fought, and many of them perished in that awful place that they call Devil's Wood. But how many of us venture beyond Longueval? From the centre of the village at the bottom of the road that heads north, you can see a simple green sign put there by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. It points to the summit of a ridge, which you can see in the distance, maybe half a mile away. And on that sign, it simply says, New Zealand Forces Memorial, Longueval. If you take that narrow road uphill, preferably on foot, you won't know it, but you'll soon be crossing a point where thousands of troops on the other side of the world went over the bags, as they called it, at 6:20 a.m. on the 15th of September, 1916. This was part of the Battle of the Somme, and it was to become known as the Battle of Fleurs-Corcelette. If you continue along that road, within a couple of minutes, you'll reach the objective, the New Zealanders from the other side of the world, their first major objective. It was called Crest Trench. And it's not difficult to understand why it was called Crest Trench by the staff officers who drew up these trench maps. It sits upon the crest of the hill where, after the war, it was decided to build the memorial that was signposted just behind us. Now, I visited this spot last week, and after 20 odd years of going to the Somme, shame to say, really, this was the first time that I'd walked the battleground, the battlefield that those New Zealanders fought over all those years ago. It was freezing cold, and the rains of the previous few weeks had created large puddles that had now been frozen over. I was guiding a family from Auckland in New Zealand, and we were following in the footsteps of two of their relatives that had fought here. Their 16-year-old daughter had never seen icy puddles before, and it wasn't long before she was trying to smash them, but without any success. She was distracted, really, I suppose, by these puddles that she'd not seen before, rather than what happened here. But over the next couple of hours, her focus changed. Why were we there? What had interrupted the Davies family holiday to Europe? Why had they come from the other side of the world to this lonely spot in the middle of a field in rural France? Well, today on this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales and the Battlefields, we're going to find out why. We're going to dig deep and discover what happened to two boys who fought and died on this battlefield that will be forever part of New Zealand. So in the next hour or so, come with me on this journey to remember those boys who volunteered to fight for their small nation and the British Empire, and many of them never made it home again. And I wonder, as they made their way up that day to the front line, I wonder whether they sang songs. I'm sure they did. I wonder whether those songs went something like this.
Falls through my veins. Now not having marched in my boots. I find it so hard to explain. I wear this badge with honor on my country's uniform. No, I'm no superhero. I've learned the duties I perform. From a working class background, just a regular Kiwi kid, I went to school and played rugby like most of us did. Played make-believe war games back when we were boys, and G.I. Joe was one of my favorite toys. Raise a flag, raise it up. Raise a flag up to the top. Raise a flag up for the flag on high. Oh, New Zealand, my homeland, you're worth the sacrifice to keep our country proud and free. Oh, New Zealand, my homeland, Pacific paradise. So young and oh so proud. Follow that dream, they'd say. Well, I followed mine. It took me just a moment to sign the dotted line. Raise a flag, raise it up. Raise a flag up to the top. Raise a flag and fill the flag on.
Now, having listened to the words of that song, the soldiers wouldn't have listened to that because that was recorded by a modern band of New Zealand soldiers, and it's simply called the NZ Soldier Song, but the words certainly do take us back to how those young men must have felt on those battlefields of the Somme in 1916. Now, just before we go any further, I have recorded another podcast about this battle with Pete Smith, in September of 2022, I think it was, when we looked at two different divisions that went over the top that day. So if you want to listen to that back, then please go and find that in the archive. But today we're going to follow in the footsteps of the New Zealand division that went into action that day, and in particular these two soldiers whose relatives I was guiding around the battlefield last week. Now, just to set the scene as well for the part that the New Zealand Division were going to play in the battle on the 15th of September, I've used, as I often do, one of the pen and sword books, Battleground Europe, Fleurs and Goodicord, and it was written by a man called Trevor Pigeon. And he explains that the New Zealand Division had arrived in France following their withdrawal from Gallipoli, and alongside the Australians, the entire Anzac contingent had won much admiration for their courage and spirit. And their role on the battlefield, they were positioned between Fleurs and High Wood, and their role was to safeguard the flank of the attack to the north. Now, from their jumping off positions, the German front line was about 300 or 400 yards away on the left, but only 200 or 300 yards away on the right. And there was a trench here that ran almost alongside their frontline positions called Coffee Lane. Their first objective was Crest Trench that I mentioned earlier, 200 yards or more further along, and then the mighty Switch Trench, hidden behind the crest of the slope at which the New Zealanders had to attack. Their divisional front was between 800 and 900 yards across, and at 6:20 a.m. these men left their trenches, formed up, and then closed up behind that creeping barrage as it proceeded up the slope. As it moved, they could see the lanes that were left open for the tanks themselves, but they couldn't see them because the tanks were late in setting out from their start point behind them in Longueval. There were supposed to be four tanks that were going to support the infantry, and they did, but as I said, that's a story for another podcast. So without the tanks in support, the attacking infantry forced their way up that slope where we were standing. They were singing as they went. They found little opposition in Coffee Lane, but now they encountered withering machine gun and rifle fire that was coming from Crest Trench, and this caused severe casualties. But the New Zealanders jumped into that trench and the opposition melted away. And this was where a man called Sergeant Donald Forrester Brown was to carry out his action that were to result in him being awarded the Victoria Cross, and we're going to talk about him later on. Now, having cleared Crest Trench, they then had to walk down the slope on the other side, and it was further than I thought, to be honest. When I looked at the trench map, I thought that the New Zealanders, having gone past Crest Trench, would soon find themselves on top of that switch line. But it took us about 20 minutes, I suppose. I bet it's a good half a mile. You walk down the slope, there's a track junction, you turn right and it leads you to Fleur. And that was the site, that was the position of this enormous, deep and highly defended, heavily defended switch trench, which ran all the way from Fleur across the back of High Wood. Now, in amongst those New Zealanders was the 2nd Battalion of the Auckland Regiment. And a man called William Timmins was a private, service number 25/1211. And he'd come from a place called Somerstown in New Zealand, the son of John and Kate Timmins. And somewhere along the line, he was wounded and evacuated from the trenches and taken back to a casualty clearing station, probably 15 miles behind the lines at Hiley Station. And he was a distant cousin through marriage of Mark Davey. And it was his family that I was walking those battlefields with that day. And like most people that follow in the footsteps of their relatives, it was highly emotional for Mark and his family. He was there with his wife and son and daughter. And they'd travelled, as I said, from the other side of the world as part of a European tour. And this was a pilgrimage that Mark had wanted to do all his life. He'd been here a few years earlier. He'd been to see his relative's grave as he died of wounds in that casualty clearing station at Hiley Station. But he hadn't got the information about where they'd attacked. They'd been to the New Zealand Memorial that we just visited, but they hadn't walked the battlefield as he was doing that day. That beautiful winter's day, it was about -6, but it meant nothing to him as he walked the footsteps. And somewhere between the New Zealand Memorial or Crest Trench down to the switch line, somewhere there, his relative had been mortally wounded. Now, a few days later, it was the turn of the 2nd Battalion of the Canterbury Regiment within the New Zealand Forces to try and consolidate those gains and push on further. And it was the 21st of September that Private Arthur John Ricks, another relative of my guest from New Zealand, went into action, and he was to lose his life on that day. And like 1,205 others, he's remembered on the Caterpillar Valley New Zealand Memorial, just about a mile away. In fact, we could see the memorial from where we were walking on that day. And this is what happened to his battalion on that day. They were ordered to take Goose Alley during the night of the 20th and the 21st. They passed through the 2nd Battalion of the Aucklanders and they drew up at 8:30 p.m. in this sunken road. And after some stiff fighting, success of their attack was very much in doubt. They did manage to take all their objectives, very largely as a result of the help and encouragement given by the Aucklanders. There was a Sergeant Gordon, and they called him Old Tom Gordon of the 15th Company, and he was particularly prominent at one crucial moment. He rallied the attacking force when they were giving way, and he led them on to this victory. As usual, the Germans counterattacked at dawn, but they were driven off. They came again in the afternoon. They had no better fortune. During this attack, the Auckland Battalion headquarters did some excellent sharpshooting, and the Trench Mortar Battery under Lieutenant Jock McKenzie also did some fine work. Now, in a report published after the battle, the New Zealanders said that the enemy was strong, well organised, well led, and determined to maintain their unbroken line. Progress could only be made by hard fighting, and even then, progress was slow and very costly. Good soldier, as the New Zealander is in open warfare, he is nowhere better than in the shock of battle. His ability to take punishment, his steadfastness, endurance and core, desperate daring have never shone out more splendidly than on this great occasion. The New Zealanders' battalion war diary is quite neatly handwritten, which makes it useful when we're trying to work out what happened, and it gives us a little bit more detail. It says that at 5:30 p.m, having taken their objectives, the Germans delivered a determined counterattack without any warning, and there was about 200 of the enemy attacked via Goose Alley, Flirt's support trench and the Flirt's line. The bombers were well organised, bold and expert, and had an advantage over the men who had been fighting all night and digging all day. The enemy were eventually routed by a bayonet charge over the open. In this action, about 20 prisoners were taken, most of them wounded, a large quantity of material and 4 machine guns, 2 of which were damaged in the bomb fighting. Almost 300 German dead were counted, and of the counterattack force, about 100 were killed. We went into action with 18 officers and just 523 other ranks. The casualty numbers, 7 officers killed, 40 wounded, none reported missing, but amongst other ranks, 32 other ranks had been killed, 156 other ranks were wounded, and 49 were missing. Now, by my calculations, that means that over 250 had become casualties, and that's just over 50% of their fighting strength, which was already depleted when they went into action that day. But this wasn't a failed attack. They had achieved all their objectives and fought off the German counterattacks as well. But somewhere along the line, Private Arthur Ricks was killed and became one of 7,500 New Zealand casualties of the Great War that are either commemorated or buried in France alone. It had originally been reported on his casualty form that he'd been wounded in action, but whatever happened, he was never seen again, and his parents back home in a place called Manawatu in Wellington in New Zealand never did find out what happened to him. And as I said, he's now one of those that's remembered on the memorial to the missing just a few hundred yards away. As we stood there was a couple of things that happened back home in New Zealand. It was late at night, but Mark managed to video his mum using his iPhone, and she could see through the modern technology the battlefield where her own relative had died, and perhaps he was still here. We'll never know, but that must have been quite an emotional moment for mother and son to share that moment together. And then we look back across the battlefield on this beautiful winter's day. You could see for miles on the Somme in all directions. And we looked uphill and we could still see the New Zealand Memorial in the distance. This memorial was unveiled in October 1922. And like so many other New Zealand memorials, it takes the form of a column raised on a step base. And at the base on each side, there's a panel. And the memorial says it's dedicated in honour of the men of the New Zealand Division, First Battle of the Somme, 1916. And the bit that really got me, on one of the panels it says, "From the uttermost ends of the earth." There's an information panel just at the entrance to the memorial, and it gives us quite a lot more information about the New Zealanders on the Somme. It says that they were actually involved, the division was actually involved in 4 separate attacks on the 15th, 25th, 27th of September, and the 1st of October, plus several smaller operations in between, and that the New Zealand infantry remained in the front line for 23 consecutive days and its artillery batteries had participated for much longer. And in between these times, it rained on the battlefield, reducing the topsoil to mud and filling the shell holes with water, and corpses littered the battlefield, and the stench of death lingered over everything. New Zealand soldiers, like those from all other nations, endured this degrading existence until they were finally relieved from the battlefield. And more than 2,000 New Zealand soldiers lost their lives during the Battle of the Somme in the autumn of 1916, and roughly 6,000 more were wounded. Most of the dead have no known grave, and those that do are buried in the Caterpillar Valley Cemetery that we're going to visit later on in this podcast. There was a Lieutenant Alexander Aitken that was serving with the Otago Regiment that day, and we can now listen to his words that he wrote after his experience on the 15th of September 1916.
Alexander Aitken was born in Dunedin on the 1st of April 1895, and he attended Otago Boys High School. He became head boy and won a scholarship to Otago University, where he studied languages and mathematics. In April 1915, Aitken enlisted in the New Zealand Expeditionary Force. He left New Zealand for Egypt in August that year and served with the Otago Battalion in the later stages of the Gallipoli campaign. He then sailed for France with the 1st Battalion, the Otago Regiment. Badly wounded near Goose Alley, close to Fleur, Aitken had to survive being left out in no man's land. Taking shelter in a crater, he contemplated his survival.
Bullets still hissed above my shell hole. A raised hand would have been perforated at once. It was out of the question to think of crawling back.
Aitken was soon forced to move from the safety of the bomb crater and find his way back to his own lines.
I watched carefully and saw that shells from a 5.9 or a 4.1 howitzer were coming closer every 2 minutes, apparently in a straight line. I visualised the German gunners lowering their howitzers by a fraction of angle each time. I reckoned that in about 10 minutes, one of these shells would fall near my crater, possibly on it. Being blown to pieces or killed by blasts seemed worse than the machine guns. Using what cover I could, I crawled from my shell hole over to our original right, now my left, out of line of fire.
Narrowly avoiding the shell fire creeping towards him, Aitken collected himself.
There was nothing for it but to wait until dark, when, if machine gun fire should die down, I might hope to crawl back overland to somewhere near the starting point of our attack, where the trench would be occupied by the 10th Company and would be in better repair. The distance would be about 500 yards.
Luckily for Aitken, the rain stopped and the sky cleared. He recognised some constellations and used the stars to guide him southwards. Mustering all of his remaining strength, he continued to crawl back to his lines.
At length I saw outlined in black against the rain-washed night sky the figures of two men on a mound digging. I recognised them, Alf Ellis of my old section and Lou Milchreist, a Manxman, also of the 10th Company, which had evidently come up from supplies to hold the line. I called Alf. Instantly the figures vanished. 3 or 4 minutes passed, and then I felt a prod in the rear with a bayonet. A foot pressed in the hollow of my back, and, "Who's this? Speak!" "Your old corporal, Alf," I said. "Steady with that bayonet." They bent down, recognized me, and returned to the trench for a stretcher, but all the stretchers must have been in use. Here the picture fades still more, but since the next thing I remembered is the earthy parapet, I had evidently crawled the last 15 yards.
Aitken spent 3 months in a military hospital in London before returning to New Zealand in January 1917. The following year, he returned to his university studies, then headed to Scotland, where he became Professor of Mathematics at Edinburgh University. Left with physical and mental scars, he went on to write one of New Zealand's best First World War memoirs, Gallipoli to the Somme, published in 1963. He was also a very talented musician, and the violin he carried throughout the First World War is now a treasured artefact at Otago Boys High School in Dunedin.
As I'm listening to that, indeed, we played that recording when we were walking the battlefield with Mark and his family. It occurred to me that that's the fortune of battle, the fortune of war, isn't it? That Alexander Aitken somehow managed to avoid those artillery shells and everything else that was being fired at him as he made his way back to his own trenches. He could have been killed by his own men. They didn't know who it was. He had to shout out and convince them that he was a friendly face that was coming back to the trenches wounded. And he managed to survive the evacuation process. He made it back to New Zealand and he succeeded in life. He achieved so much in his life. But a different fate was to befall the two soldiers that we were following. Both were wounded, we know that from their intact service records. One was subsequently killed and has no known grave, and the other did make it back to a casualty clearing station, where he sadly succumbed to his wounds the next day. How different it was for Alexander, and how thankful we all are for that, as he can tell us exactly what it was like on that day. Now, I've got a couple more accounts of the battle on the 15th that I'd like to read to you. One is a published account, and here we're talking about the 2nd Battalion of the Aucklanders that Walter Timmins was serving with, the man that was wounded. And it says, throughout the 13th and the 14th of September, it means, the Australians made a steady creep forward in preparation for the battle. The Hun artillery was very active and a number of men were killed and wounded. Companies were drawn up in four waves with an interval of 50 yards between each wave on a total frontage of 600 yards. The night was bitterly cold. A light misty rain fell intermittently and the hours passed miserably. All night the guns were active and towards morning the firing grew more intense. At 6 o'clock there was a considerable rattle of machine gun fire. The stationary barrage was falling in the rear of the enemy line and there was a constant sighing and droning in the air as big howitzer shells went over. At 6:20 a.m. in a wide circle of flame and a great crash of sound, the creeping barrage fell onto the German trenches. One veteran described the creeping barrage. He says, the noise of the battle when you're out in the middle of it is so terrific that you don't hear any individual shots even. The noise rose to a crescendo such as I've never heard before. You wouldn't hear a word. So going back to our published account of what happened at Fleurs, it says, it was the signal and the whole attack moved forward with a thrust and weight that was irresistible. The Aucklanders and Otagos went straight forward in the lines of assault, and behind them, as far as the eye could see, with the battalions of the Rifle Brigade moving in sections in artillery formation. To the right and left were the files of Guardsmen, South African, English Territorials and Irishmen. Here and there, not quite keeping pace with the infantry, were the tanks, the mysterious new weapons of war, whose advent had been heralded by a confused rumour, but no certainty. Now they were a real presence. An inspiration of victory to our men, a great fear and terror to the enemy. There was a steady surge forward of the whole vast mass. It was a wonderful and inspiring, a stupendous sight. Scarcely, however, had the first line left the shell holes in which they had assembled than the rockets went soaring up from the German posts, calling urgently for the protective barrage of their guns. The response was immediate, accurate and very deadly. It took a terrible toll, but it did not shake the steadfast courage of the moving mass. Men dropped quietly by twos and threes. Sometimes a whole section was blown out. What had been no man's land was full of dead. Very eagerly, the Aucklanders pressed forward close to the heels of their barrage. They were too eager. They pressed too closely, and many fall from the burst of their own shells. Crest Trench, the Hun observation post, is reached. A few shots and bayonet thrusts and it is passed. Now there's a quickening of the pulse. Below, in the rain of shells, is the switch line. They close down upon it. 40 yards away, the leading waves merge. They wait for the barrage to lift. There is shooting and bombing at short range. The line of gleaming bayonets, of staring eyes and of set, drawn faces, is waiting for the signal to dash into this trench that's packed with Huns. In places, the enemy stands shoulder to shoulder. Now the stick grenades are coming over in showers, for there are brave men amongst them who see that if they can stay this attacking line, hold it at bombing range for a few moments, then the time of grace will have passed, the machine guns will come into play, and the Englanders, as they thought they were, will be mown down, as they have been time and time again during the last few weeks. But now the third wave has come up. Lieutenants Tuck, Cooper, Senior and Stewart, the platoon commanders, Sergeant Hill, Gordon, the section leaders, Men here and there all along the line take the initiative. The wave breaks over the Hun line. Many of the enemy died fighting very bravely. Many were shot down, endeavouring to retreat down the hill. Some were bayoneted, screaming for mercy. But none except the wounded escaped. Few prisoners were taken by the 2nd Battalion of the Aucklanders. The 4th wave came in, and at once a start was made with a consolidation of the position. Generally speaking, the new line was taken up about 50 yards in front of Switch Trench. The Rifle Brigade passed through and went on to the more distant objectives, a few of the Aucklanders going with them. Indeed, Lieutenant Tuck and some of the men had made no stop at all, but pushed on through the barrage until they saw the ruins of Fleur. And then the battalion of the 2nd Aucklanders, they dug in for dear life. It was well they did so, for the German fire was extremely heavy all day long. During the period of consolidation, the battalion lost some of its best officers. Captain Armstrong started off, his walking stick in one hand, his overcoat thrown over his arm, walking coolly through the bursting shells. He reached the company objective and was, with magnificent coolness and an utter contempt for danger, was directing his men where to dig in when he was hit through the arm and chest and fell mortally wounded. He was a man who, if he had lived, would have risen higher. Captain Keith Hunter, one of the most able and popular officers the battalion ever had, was sitting in the same shell hole as Captain Granger, who, though very ill, insisted on coming to the battle. Word was brought of the death of Sergeant Major Wallace Hunter. "Well, he died like a soldier anyway," remarked his cousin. The words were hardly out of his mouth when there was a shrieking in the air, a burst, and he too lay dying, while Captain Granger was wounded. Carter, the signal corporal, followed the whole advance. He it was who took the telephone wire across Switch Line and right into Fleur Village, from where at 9 a.m. he transmitted the first message through to Brigade HQ. There all day long, under extremely heavy shellfire, he passed backwards and forwards, mending breaks and keeping the line of communication clear. Brown, the stretcher bearer, commenced the wonderful work that continued through the next 3 weeks, and it was to earn him a reputation for bravery and devotion to duty, second to no man in the whole battalion. Just reading that, it made me think back to when I first started this podcast. It's nearly 2 years ago now, and I wanted to talk about some of these forgotten soldiers that are not mentioned in the history books. And as I'm reading that account, there's several soldiers there that were so brave, one man going into an officer going with his men when he didn't feel well. And without this podcast and others, these stories will have been forgotten about, but they won't be now. And hopefully, when you go to the Somme, you'll follow in the footsteps of these soldiers and take these accounts with you. It really does bring the battlefield to life when you're there, when you can see the positions that they're talking about. You can see the lie of the land, and certainly you can see the village of Fleur over to your right. And when you turn round, you can see Longueval, you can see High Wood. As you turn round up to your right, Delville Wood to your left. And probably the most important feature, that New Zealand memorial in the distance. Now, the other source that I always like to quote, because they give a different perspective on what happened, is from newspapers. And I found an account in one of the New Zealand newspapers that gives us a different description of what happened on that day. And it says, "Wounded New Zealanders are arriving from the Somme front, where they were transferred from the Armand Terry's sector a month ago. All stories confirm their splendid courage on the morning of September the 15th in the face of the greatest trial that had yet experienced. The father of the young family, who was gravely wounded, said, 'When our boys went over, it was a magnificent sight. The first wave consisted of Otago and Aucklanders. They stepped out fearlessly, despite the hurricane bombardment and the incessant whizzing of machine gun bullets. Those whose sons and brothers were killed here can be well proud. It was a glorious death. Heavily loaded, unable to run and carrying shovels and equipment. Unlike raiders who go out to return, it was a moving day for these men, and things did move. They found a new place to sleep that night, although there were many gaps as a result of those first 2 hours in the open. They walked in extended order over no man's land, dodging the shell holes. German dead were lying everywhere as a result of the enemy's earlier fruitless attacks. English regiments were cooperating with our right, and several tanks were allocated to our front. We were vastly impressed by these new engines, and were delighted to notice the Germans funk when they realised their deadly powers. When the first tank sailed out, 14 German bombers rushed out, thinking it was an ordinary armoured car and hoping to stop it before it reached the trench. They threw scores of bombs which exploded harmlessly, and the tank's machine gun wiped out the whole party. The Germans quickly learned to respect the monsters, which, when they developed greater speed, would be even more terrible menace to the defenders of trenches. "We felt we were right into it this time," said another soldier. "Although we'd lost several men, notably a number of Maoris, during the previous 3 weeks by gas attacks and bombardments, our first proper action was on the Somme front. When we learned the magnitude of our operations and our important part, a thrill went right through all of us. Everybody was cheerful, although they knew of a certainty that would not survive. Our bombardment was beyond description. The Germans declare we do not know what shellfire is until we've been in the trenches. The German bombardment was severe enough and caught many of our chaps before the advance. The assault on the trenches was quick, rough work, but with few moments for rest and no time to watch a comrade's fate. A single thought was in every mind, get ahead. The result was the New Zealanders entered Fleur before the Coldstreams, Irish, Canadian, Scottish and other English units. We were all mixed up in the finish. The Otago men and the Aucklanders took the first line. They waited till the Rifle Brigade came up and then pushed on, taking the second line in an overwhelming dash. Then all the New Zealanders combined in a final push. The Dinkums, as the Rifles are called, proved themselves among the best. Some of our men got beyond the village and they suffered from the machine guns. Another man, a pioneer, said, "It was laughable to watch the Germans surrendering. They came into our trenches, running, rolling, limping and crawling. A Hawke's Bay man with a broken arm, helping to drag a Dunedin comrade more seriously wounded, became indignant on seeing a huge German carried on a stretcher and determined that his comrade should be relieved from his painful crawl. He saw two Germans scared to death, running from shell hole to shell hole, shouting, 'Kamerad!' The Hawke's Bay man shouted, 'Stop!' They did not comprehend, so he picked up his rifle and they quickly understood. They approached and dropped on their knees. A burly German carried the Dunedin man a mile and a half to the rear. Before the battle, General Birdwood again appeared, unescorted in almost every trench, renewing his acquaintance with the Gallipoli veterans. The men speak in the highest terms of the New Zealander General Russell. They express surprise at seeing a cinema operator in the front trenches on Friday morning, coolly filming the advance. The men say it do our people good to see the magnificent steadiness of this great attack. Another New Zealand boy, badly hit in the jaw, speaking behind his bandages, said, "According to General Haig's latest, our chaps are still holding the line. You bet your life that we will stick it as long as needed." The wounded are concentrated at Brockenhurst and Walton, and as soon as they are convalescent, they will be sent to Hornchurch and Codford. Some, owing to pressure, were sent to isolated hospitals, but quickly recovered and transferred to New Zealand hospitals, all of which are working smoothly. There are no complaints, and the men especially appreciate the New Zealand mutton and the butter. Must have been a tremendous relief, mustn't it, to those New Zealanders so far from home, reaching England, being looked after properly, in some cases in hospitals that were being managed by their own people, and then eating their own wonderful New Zealand food. Now, I mentioned earlier that one of those men that was serving with the Otago Regiment that day, Sergeant Donald Forrester Brown, was subsequently posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions on the first day of the battle. He was killed a couple of weeks later, the 1st of October 1916, aged 26, and he's now buried in the Wallencourt Cemetery, which is on the main road between Albert and Bapaume, not far from the Butte de Wallencourt. Now, he was the first member of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force on the Western Front to be awarded the Victoria Cross. Eventually, I think there was about 16 of them that were awarded this highest honour. He was born in Dunedin in 1890. Worked as a farmer, and he enlisted in October of 1915 and arrived in France in 1916 with the rest of his comrades. His unit had been tasked with capturing a series of German-held trenches, as we know, and as they moved towards their second objective, they came under intense machine gun fire and there were heavy casualties, but his citation explains what he did next. And it says, "For most conspicuous bravery and determination in attack, when the company to which he belonged had suffered very heavy casualties in officers and men from machine gun fire, At great personal risk, this NCO advanced with a comrade and succeeded in reaching a point within 30 yards of the enemy guns. Four of the gun crew were killed and they captured the gun. The advance of the company was continued until it was again held up by machine gun fire. Again, Brown and his comrade, with great gallantry, rushed the gun and killed the crew. After this second position had been won, the company came under very heavy shell fire, and the utter contempt for danger and coolness under fire of this NCO did much to keep up the spirit of his men. On a subsequent occasion in attack, Sergeant Brown showed most conspicuous gallantry. He attacked single-handed a machine gun which was holding up the attack, killed the gun crew and captured the gun. But later, while sniping the retreating enemy, this very gallant soldier was killed. So on our pilgrimage last week, we then walked beyond what was the location of Switch Trench. We turned right, we went down into the village of Fleur. We stood and looked at the magnificent memorial in the village, the 41st Division. And then we wandered back up, picked up our car and drove the short distance to Caterpillar Valley Cemetery. And there within that cemetery is the memorial to the missing, which contains the names of 1,205 New Zealanders that died on the Somme that have no known grave. And we know from the records they eventually establish that 73 men died that day, and amongst them was the man that we were looking for, Arthur Ricks. 53 of those men that died that day in his unit are remembered on the memorial itself, but there are 7 graves within this beautiful cemetery. Again, it's a position where you can see so much of the Somme battlefield perched as it is on top of a ridge. In fact, last week we could see both the beginning of the battle, we could see across to Montauban in the south of the battlefield where there was some success on the 1st of July. And then when we turn round, we can look beyond those horseshoe of woods that were taken during the months of July, August and September, and turn round again and we can see the direction that we came from. And in the distance, you can just about see on a clear day as it was last week, the town of Bapaume, which of course was one of the first objectives of the battle that was never taken during the fighting. It was only taken when the Germans withdrew in the following March. But in this cemetery, we were there to look at Arthur's name on the memorial. But like we often do, we wanted to see whether we could find a possible grave for him. Now, Caterpillar Valley is one of those cemeteries where many of the burials were brought in from the battlefields and from other smaller cemeteries and concentrated into this cemetery. There's now 5,573 Commonwealth burials and commemorations there, but of those, an incredible 3,798 of the burials are unidentified. And there are 7 identified burials here from the battalion that we're looking for, or we were looking for, the 2nd Canterbury Regiment. 4 of them are grouped together in one row, and we wandered along and looked at those named headstones. And then not far away is what we were looking for. There was 6 headstones that said, "A New Zealand soldier of the Great War, known unto God." Perhaps, just perhaps, one of these headstones, one of these burials, was that of Arthur Ricks. Well, now, never know, of course, but then just a few yards away is the memorial to the missing itself, and that's where we went next. And it wasn't long before the family found the entry, Ricks, AJ, and they stood there wondering what that man was like and what would become of him had he survived the war. And in the middle of this walled memorial is a plinth with the New Zealand cap badge on the top, and it says, "Here are recorded the names of officers and men of New Zealand who fell in the battles of the Somme, September and October 1916, and whose graves are known only to God." And the other aspect that we looked at while we were there, when we were looking at some of the identified burials in Caterpillar Valley, is the fact that officially none of these New Zealand headstones should have a family inscription. As we've talked about in other podcasts, the Imperial War Graves Commission and the government made a mistake at the end of the war when they decided to charge families 3.5 old pence per letter, including spaces, up to a maximum of 66 characters. And the New Zealand government made the decision that no inscriptions would ever be entered on their headstones. I'm sure there are one or two exceptions to that. There always are, aren't there? But certainly none that we saw in Caterpillar Valley had personal inscriptions on. Now, Mark and his family had never seen the name of their relative on the wall, and before we left, I explained to them that in November 2004, the remains of an unidentified New Zealand soldier was exhumed from a particular grave, plot 14, row A, grave 27, and taken back to New Zealand. This was the New Zealand unknown warrior. And of course, there is a very slim outside chance that this man could have been Arthur Ricks himself. Now, the idea of repatriating a New Zealand unknown soldier back to his home country had been discussed many times in the past, but it wasn't until 2002 that the agreement was reached with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission to repatriate the remains of a New Zealand soldier that had been killed in the First World War. And it was decided that the National War Memorial was the most appropriate place for the tomb, and that the tomb should be outside rather than within the Hall of Memories, because that would allow greater public access. In 2004, the contract to design and construct the tomb was awarded to the Kingsley Baird design team from Wellington. And in, as I said earlier, November 2004, ceremonies were held in France and New Zealand to repatriate and inter New Zealand's unknown warrior. So we pause for a few moments at the memorial before we made our way, following the footsteps, following the route that their other soldier that we were following, Walter Timmins from the 2nd Battalion of the Auckland Regiment, having been wounded on the 15th of September, he'd have been taken using the well-established evacuation process to his casualty clearing station beyond Albert on the road to Amiens at a railway junction, a railway station that was there, Hyley Station. And that's where we went next. Now, when you look on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, you discover that Hyley was the position of the 36th Casualty Clearing Station from April 1916, and the cemetery itself was begun in May 1916, and the last burial made in May of 1919. And there's now 2,890 Commonwealth servicemen of the First World War that are buried or commemorated there. Only 12 of the burials are unidentified, because most of these soldiers, if not all of them, would have died of their wounds. So, of course, when they reach there, they know who they are. And there's also 83 German graves. These are men, prisoners of war, that have been brought back from the Somme battles, treated in the same way that our own men would be treated, but subsequently died of their wounds. Now, it's a very unusual cemetery, because the burials in this cemetery were carried out under extreme pressure in August and September of 1916, as the Somme battle raged to the east, and many of the graves are either too close together to be marked individually, or some of the plots that we look at contain multiple burials. Some of the headstones carry as many as three sets of casualty details, and where that is the case, they didn't have room to put their regimental badges on the headstone. So instead, 117 of these regimental or national badges have been carved on the cloister wall that's on the north side of the cemetery. And this cemetery was designed by probably the most famous of the Commission's architects, Sir Edwin Lutyens, the man that designed the cenotaph in London. And when we arrived, it wasn't long before we went to plot 4, row D, grave number 65. And there they placed a small wooden cross at the grave of Private William Timmings. He was 25 years old when he died of his wounds on the 16th of September 1916, a day after he'd been wounded by a gunshot wound to his hip. And there aren't three burials in his plot, there's two. There's an Englishman with him, a rifleman J. Allen from the King's Royal Rifle Corps, who died on the same day. So there is actually room for the New Zealand crest on his headstone. And we stood there for a few moments while the family consider what William may have achieved in his life had he survived the Battle of the Somme. It's always even more emotional when people from the other side of the world, like Australia, South Africa and New Zealand, come to these graves. Because as we looked at the headstone of William, we think of his parents, Kate and John, back home in New Zealand. And we know that they didn't get the chance to come and visit William's grave, and the family were doing that on their behalf, as they were at Caterpillar Valley, where they thought of Arthur Ricks, who has no known grave. These are always very special moments, moments that I've shared, I don't know, must be dozens of families over the last 20 years from all over the world, from all over the UK and beyond. And it's always very emotional, and it's what makes me want to do these personal visits. It's something, I think I've said this before, that when I stood at my great uncle's grave in 2001 for the first time at Buzincourt, I said then that I wanted to help other families find out what happened to their relatives. It would give some meaning to the death of my own great uncle, aged just 20. And it's moments like that that help me, fill me with such satisfaction, and also creates a bond of friendship that will be there forever with these people that just, what, 3 or 4 days ago I'd never met before, and they lived about as far as you could possibly live away from where I live in England. It's an emotion that's difficult to describe, really. You've really got to be there at the time to understand it. And I know that so many of you listening to this podcast will have been through those emotions as well. Now, one of the others that died on the 15th of September 1916 and is remembered on the Caterpillar Valley New Zealand Memorial, because he has no known grave, is Private William Alfred Prince, another one that was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Auckland Regiment. Maybe he was a mate of William Timmings. He was 31 years old and he was a native of Auckland, as so many of them were. Now, 2 days before he died, he wrote a letter back home to New Zealand to his fiancée. And in this recording, we listen to the contents of that letter that was sent to his fiancée, and it's read by his nephew, Peter Thompson. And listening to the recording was the granddaughter of the fiancée that he never married. She obviously went on and got married again. But I'd like you to listen to this, because again, it brings home the sentiment from those battlefields to the people that were there, spoken through the eyes of those relatives.
France, September 13, 1916. Dear Mother, Jean and all.
Billy Prince died in 1916. But my mother married in 1919.
I cannot describe it. It would perhaps be as big as the bush at Papakura, but now it is just a mass of broken timber. Hardly a decent-sized tree stands, all broken and smashed by shell fire.
Fascinating, isn't it? Finding out little bits of family history and people. And you see, some of them have got personalities and some haven't. Depends, doesn't it? If you know somebody, or somebody's like somebody else, you can see it. But you never hear their voices, and you don't know them as people.
We came across quite a few dead Germans in the wood I referred to. They had been missed and not buried. I took a button off one poor beggar's coat as a souvenir.
So what did it mean to you, sitting there and hearing that read out, the letter that was written to your mother?
I only heard bits and pieces of it.
Old Fritz is getting something to keep him thinking. There's a devil of a shock in store for him in a day or two. You will probably hear about them in the papers.
I was quite impressed of the little bit I did hear. And I thought, oh yes.
14th. Have just received orders to move. Cannot write more. Fond love to you all. From your loving son, Will.
I don't know whether you picked it up, but I was looking at the video of that on YouTube and I could see his great nephew, his voice was breaking and his eyes were tearful. And I must admit, it brought a lump to my throat as well. So I think it's time that we should play the New Zealand national anthem, sang by Rebecca Nelson at one of the Gallipoli commemorations a few years ago.
Come.
brings tears to your eyes, doesn't it, when we think about what we'd experienced over the course of last week. And I'm not even from New Zealand. Imagine how it must feel if you're from New Zealand, if you're relatives of those soldiers that we've just been talking about. So let's hear from the Davey family. Let's hear what they thought about it all.
So we're just finishing up our tour with our friends from near Auckland in New Zealand. And we spent the last 3 or 4 days visiting important points of interest on the concern the New Zealand forces that were here in World War One. We've been to Messines on the first day and Tynecott, Gravenstall Ridge. We've been to parts of the Somme, and we went to where the New Zealanders fought in 1918. So we've covered a lot of ground over the last few days. But most importantly, we've gone to the ground where two of their relatives were in action during the Battle of Fleurs, the Tank Battle of Fleurs, Courcelette, September 1916. One of them was killed, Arthur Ricks. He was killed, has no known grave. Remember on the Caterpillar Valley, I can't even say it, memorial to the New Zealanders. And the other one, Timmins, died the next day of his wounds and is buried in the Highley Station Cemetery. So I've been to all these places. And what I'd like to do now is get the thoughts of our clients, of our guests that have been with me on the Somme the last few days. They've travelled from the other side of the world as part of a bigger European tour. And let's first of all speak to Mark. What are your thoughts? What brought you here in the first place then, Mark? What sparked your interest?
As you said, Terry, Arthur Ricks is a great-grandfather on Mum's side, his cousin, I think it is. And we found out about him a year ago now when we were doing a bit of family research. So that's on that side. And then William Timmins is on my father's side. And whilst he's not a blood relative, he's my grandmother's first husband's brother-in-law. So, not a blood relative, but still an interest there, and been in the family. So always had an interest in finding out about them.
You're a long way from home. This is the first time you've been to the battlefields?
No. We came over in 2019 with the kids, and we didn't have the privilege of knowing you then and having you show us around. So we just drove around ourselves. But coming back this time has just put everything into context for us. It's just been fantastic.
Because what we did day before yesterday, I think it was -3, -4,
yeah.
And we started off at the New Zealand Memorial at Longaval, and using our trench map device and the battalion diaries and other sources, we walked the route that they walked that day, that they attacked on the 15th of September. And this is where both of your relatives, one was killed and one was mortally wounded.
Yeah.
And what did it mean to you to actually walk in their footsteps?
Oh, yeah, look, that was just really special. Having known about, Timmins especially, all my life, and knowing where he died and or got wounded and then died a day later, and then Arthur Ricks last year. Just walking that ground was just really special, knowing that, they had been there 108 years earlier.
And Ricks may still be there, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
And then yesterday we went to... Now, come on, how do we pronounce where we went yesterday? Come on, Maddie, tell us, where did we go yesterday?
Lekenwai.
What did we find at Lekenwai, Maddie?
A New Zealand museum.
And what was so special about that? Can anybody remind us? What did we find there? What was the significance of going there?
Oh, it was great having a location that New Zealanders could come to out of respect and feel part of what they did.
Yeah, because this was the place where the New Zealanders famously scaled the ladders over the ramparts, and they were quite proud, the people running the museum. They told us that they managed to get the German garrison to surrender there without the loss of a single civilian.
Yeah.
And it was quite a remarkable place. What does it mean to you coming with your family, coming with your husband all this way from New Zealand?
It's special because it's such a long way and feeling what the boys went through.
Yeah, very emotional, isn't it? Yeah. And Maddie, you're only 16. To your generation, what has it meant to you? Does it mean the same to you? Can you feel it?
I think it means the same because it's important to recognise all they did because it still has an effect on the world today.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah. It shaped the world. And without that, the world wouldn't be the same.
And your future as well. And what we're hoping is that you and Boston here are going to take on what you've learnt here and...
You can hear the raw emotion in their voices, can't you, as they talk about what it meant to them to go to the Somme and to the other places that they mentioned there. We're going to be doing a series of podcasts about the New Zealand attack in 1918, the last attack that the New Zealanders were involved with at Lekemwaw. And that's near Cumbrae, the other side of Cumbrae. And we're also going to look in detail at what the New Zealanders did on the Gravenstahl Ridge during the battle, Third Battle of Ypres, Passchendaele in 1917. And also prior to that, of course, the successful attack on the Messines Ridge. We visited that. And there's going to be three or four more podcasts following in the footsteps of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force in the Great War. But that's it for this week. Thank you once again for tuning in. Very grateful for all the reviews and ratings that you've given the podcast. If you haven't done so, it'd be very useful if you could do that. It does help spread the word. I'm hopeless at remembering to say that, but that really is a good thing if you could spare the time to do that. And we're going to play the last post in memory this week of Arthur Ricks from the 2nd Battalion of the Canterbury Regiment and William Timmings from the 2nd Battalion of the Auckland Regiment that died during the Battle of Fleurs Corselet in September of 1916 on the other side of the world from where their families lived for the rest of their lives without them.